So we're in the tail end of the NFL playoffs. The conference championships are this weekend, and many of you already know that. Of course you do, but a lot of you don't. It's a public radio crowd. You never know. For those who don't follow football, for whatever reason, too much money in it, too violent, you prefer soccer or something with less tackling and concussions, the sports writer Joe Posnanski just wants to remind you, football in this country is, well, it's big. Just hear him out.
Football is the biggest thing in America. Not the biggest sport in America. It's the biggest thing. There's nothing even close to how much football dominates our lives. 93 of the top 100 rated television shows in 2023 were football games. 93 out of 100. And of the other seven, three were college football games. It is everything to us. And the craziest part is, it's not everything to anybody else in the world. We're the only country that cares. So I wanted to get at the heart of what is it about this sport that captures our imaginations the way that it does. And it's not one thing. Is the violence a part of it? Of course it is. Is it because the sport is so perfectly made for television in a way that no other sport is? Yes, I think that's a part of it. Is gambling a part of it? Sure, gambling's a part of it. Is it that it is the one sport that can turn at any moment in a way that no other sport can?
As the clock winds out on the Philadelphia Eagles, a game they thought would project them into,
you know, when I was thinking about these moments, the moment that kept coming back to me, of course it's in the book, is the very famous miracle at the Meadowlands where the Giants are leading in the final seconds of the game and all they have to do is fall down on the ball. And they decide to run a running play. Joe Pisarcik, their quarterback, fumbles.
Wait a minute. Here's a free fly. I don't believe it. The Eagles pick it up, and Herman Edwards runs it in for a touchdown.
No other sport can give us that.
An incredible development.
No other sport can give us where there is a 100% chance of the Giants winning that game. And then 5 seconds later, there's 0% chance of them winning that game.
Just doesn't get the snap. He just loses the snap, doesn't get it. And who's right there? Herman Edwards picks it up on the dead run and goes in for a touchdown.
Every other sport, you have to build it up. In baseball, you have to be at the plate. In basketball, you have to have the ball. In hockey, you have to have the puck. Football is the one sport where at any point, you're on offense.
Thomas to the 10. Denver's going on the New England. They win it on the first play of overtime.
You're on defense.
Wilson, quick throw. And it's
good.
Intercepted. By Malcolm Butler. Butler has it at the one. Malcolm Butler.
You're kicking. You're receiving a kick. You're punting.
Deshaun Jackson gets a block. Are you kidding? Deshaun Jackson.
You can win the game right then and there. And I do think that that's a huge, huge draw because you can't rest.
Unbelievable. No time left. Eagles win.
You know, and every game matters so much. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, baseball is every day. So you go to a baseball game and the home team loses, you know, yeah, it doesn't feel great. But there's tomorrow. There's always tomorrow in baseball. That's part of baseball's charm and joy, is that there's always tomorrow. And there's not always tomorrow in football. There's no tomorrow. You know, this is today. And then if you lose, you got to wait a whole week before they play again. Plus, that might have knocked you out of the playoffs, might have knocked you out of the championship race. Every game is so important and so significant. And I think, you know, nobody really, from a number standpoint, very, very few people watch the regular season of baseball. Very, very few people watch the regular season of the NBA. Hockey, almost nobody. You have to wait for the playoffs for people to really care. But football, every single week feels like a playoff. And I think that's a very big part of why it's so big here.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this biggest thing in America. Joe Posnanski has a new book where he tells the history of the sport, or explains the popularity of the sport in 100 moments. He joined us recently to go through some of them for us. Poznanski is a sports journalist, but he's also a fan. I mean, he almost had to be.
So I was born on January 8th, 1967, which was the day of the first Super Bowl. And my entire childhood, I grew up, I'm a first generation American. And my father loved sports, still does love sports, but nobody else in my family did. And everybody else in my family, my grandparents, my mother, all my aunts and uncles, really looked down on sports. And so they would always tell me this story because I was this fanatical sports fan from my youngest days. And they would tell me this story all the time about how my father was watching a football game when I was born, that, you know, everybody else was really nervous. It was my, you know, I was the first one born, and everybody else was kind of, you know, just hanging on every, you know, word from the doctor. And my father was off in a corner watching a football game. And I remember thinking about, I thought, well, of course, I don't blame him. It was the Super Bowl. I mean, of course he was watching football. That's what he should have been doing when I was born. And then when I was 15 years old, I found out, I looked it up and found out that the Super Bowl was not played on January 8th, 1967. It was played on January 15th, 1967, which is 1 week later, which absolutely threw me because not only was the Super Bowl not played, there were no games played. It was the bye week before the Super Bowl. And I remember I just went to my parents just like, is anything true in the world anymore? Because I'd heard this story so many times growing up. And they just kept insisting that my father was watching a football game when I was born. And I said, it's not possible. And so then I looked it up and it turned out in the 1960s, they started playing a consolation football game between the third and fourth place teams for third place. Or as Vince Lombardi called it, the loser's bowl for losers.
Right. You mention in the book you are, aside from being an occasional romantic and, you know, drawn to the kind of poetry of sports, but it's also, you say you're a student of history. And the book is, these moments are a history in 100 moments. Like, it's not the greatest moments or necessarily the memorable moments. That seems to be the difference, is you are choosing these moments. And look, the greatest moments are there. The immaculate reception is there and the catch is there and the hail. We'll talk about some of these. But that doesn't seem like that's what the book's about. It's about something in these moments that says something about the larger history of football.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's funny to me that, you know, in football, we always look forward. And I thought about that so much as I was writing this book, because it is a history book. Obviously, I'm writing about the history of this game, but also, you know, the history of integration in football, which is a fascinating one and one that we haven't talked that much about. It's about how the sport grew. It's about television. To me, it feels very much like it's a, you know, it's a history of America through the lens of football. But the way I wrote it and the way I thought about it was all directed to that title, Why We Love Football.
Okay, we're not going to get to all 100, but let's get to a few.
Yeah.
Let's start with 100, Aaron Donald. This section there's actually two dates we need to take into account. There's the February 13th, 2022, but really the story begins in 2019, when Aaron Donald, who is a Los Angeles Rams defender, 2019, he's sure he's going to win the Super Bowl. And he makes this I should sort of back up and mention one of the things you say in the book is that when you are looking for a moment, you say you're looking for a specific thing. Something quite specific. I guess the specific thing for this Aaron Donald story is the promise he makes to his daughter.
Yeah, I think so. You know, this was really, and I loved leading off the book with this Aaron Donald story for a couple of reasons. Within the book, I have a little secret countdown of the 10 greatest football players who ever lived. And they are, you know, listed on the tens, I guess, you know, sort of like traffic. At 100, 90, 80, 70, 60, all the way down to 10, I rank in my order the 10 greatest football players who ever lived. So Aaron Donald, in addition to that moment being number 100, is, in my view, the 10th greatest player who ever lived. And I really wanted to start off the book that way because I don't think people have really ever appreciated how great he is, how great a player he is. And so I wanted to both start the book off with this great Aaron Donald story. As you mentioned, in 2019, he's sure they're going to win the Super Bowl. And he promises his daughter afterward that they'll be able to, you know, play after the game. Well, the Rams lose the game. And so he cannot go and play in the confetti with his daughter. So that's where it starts. And then you come to the Super Bowl. He's back in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And this time he's less confident. And they're playing the Cincinnati Bengals, and the Rams are leading, and the Bengals are driving in the final moments of the game. And not only does Aaron Donald win the Super Bowl, he kind of does it almost single-handedly. The Bengals at a third and short, the running back took the ball, and Aaron Donald broke through and not only kept him from getting the first down, but kind of grabbed him from behind. It doesn't seem physically possible to do what he did. That's just how strong he was. And then
Burrow trying to keep it going, gets spun down, gets it away, and incomplete.
On fourth down, he sacks Joe Burrow and kind of spins him to the ground, and the Rams win the game.
Running down to celebrate with a defensive play.
And guess who? Guess who? I mean, you don't even have to think about it.
And then afterward, his daughter comes on the field, and reporters trying to interview Aaron Donald, and Aaron Donald says, "Excuse me, I've got to go play with my daughter," and they go and play in the confetti on the field.
You know, I really love the approach you take for the Immaculate Reception, because it's different from some of the other ways you're telling these stories. Now, this is number four. You put this at number four. And the way you do it is you just list 100 facts about the Immaculate Reception. Let me read the first few, because this is a good setup. Number one, the Steelers trailed Oakland 7-6. Number two, there were 22 seconds left in the game. Number three, it's fourth down and 10. Talk about the Immaculate Reception. What's the angle here that you want to talk about to convey the importance of that moment in NFL history?
Yeah, this was always going to be different for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's pretty universally thought of as the greatest play in NFL history.
Yeah.
And I tend to think of it that way as well. But I knew I was going to have to do this one differently because, in addition to being the most, you know, celebrated play in NFL history, it's also the most famous. Everybody has seen it. You know, whether you're a sports fan, football fan or not, they show it constantly. Everybody has seen Terry Bradshaw dropping back to throw. He's throwing it to Frenchie Fuqua, and he and the Raiders' Jack Tatum collide. The ball goes flying backward, and it ends up right in the hands of Franco Harris, who runs it in for the touchdown.
Last chance for the Steelers. Bradshaw trying to get away, and his pass is broken up by Tatum. Tipped off. Franco Harris has it, and he's over. What? Franco Harris had the ball on a deflection. 5 seconds to go. He grabbed it with 5 seconds to go and scored.
So, with this one in particular, I thought it's not enough to tell them one new thing or two new things about it. I think I've got to just tell them every single thing I can find that they might not know. And, you know, I think the first time I wrote it, the first version of it, it was like 56. And I thought, oh, I got to get to 100. But the play itself is utterly perfect. For one moment, it has surprise. It has luck. Pittsburgh had never tasted any football success, any. They'd never won a playoff game. They'd never scored a touchdown in a playoff game. And it launched one of the great rivalries, I mean, one of the great dynasties in NFL history. They win four Super Bowls in the 70s and also have been the most, you know, celebrated and stable franchise. I mean, they've had three coaches in Pittsburgh since 1969. Three coaches. The Browns have had three coaches in the last 3 weeks. I mean, it's, you know, it's an incredible story, and it all launched with this one incredible play.
Joe Posnanski. His book is Why We Love Football, A History in 100 Moments. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about football. And they say public radio doesn't do enough sports. The sports writer Joe Posnanski is our guest, and he has a new book where he explains the appeal of football. It's more than just violence, he says. And he also breaks down some of sports' greatest moments. So you mentioned earlier that you have sort of coded in the numbers at the tens, the greats, as you see them. And we'll get to a few more in a second. But you don't list as one of the greats necessarily, or at least one of the in the tens, Dick Butkus. But you do mention him in the prologue. Played middle linebacker with the Chicago Bears for 9 years, notoriously tough and grouchy and mean, or at least that's the perception. But I guess charming off the field, at least to, as you mentioned, the fellow actors that he acted in some of these kind of dorky films, and people really liked him. Where does Butkus fit in the scheme of things? What was it about Dick Butkus that you wanted to convey for the book as you sort of got started?
It's funny, after he retired, Dick Butkus became an actor. And everybody was shocked because Dick Butkus was this ferocious, incredibly ferocious linebacker. The quotes about him were that he hated you like you were from the old neighborhood. And he just crushed and crushed and crushed people. And he very famously said that he never wanted to hurt anybody unless it was important, like a league game. So, So you have Dick Butkus as an actor, and he was playing in a movie with Raquel Welch, the legendary sex symbol and actress and all of that. And Raquel Welch loved him, just loved him. Like you said, he was super charming. And one day she's saying, you know, I just don't understand why people say bad things about Dick Butkus. He's a pussycat. He's a sweetheart. I don't understand why people say anything bad about him. And somebody in the crew piped up, yeah, don't pick up a football. And I thought, that's what this book is, right? Mm-hmm. That's the starting point of this book, because you look at a guy who's this legend for being the most ferocious player who ever lived in Dick Butkus. And, you know, it was just what football brought out of him. Mm-hmm. It wasn't who he was. It wasn't his personality. I mean, obviously, he was a tough guy. But it was what football brought out of him that made him that legendary figure that he became.
It makes me think of what football brought out of him. It makes me think of your section on Jim Brown. This is number 30. And people who don't know, he was an incredible athlete. He was probably known as the greatest lacrosse player. Basketball amazing. Casey Stengel offers him a baseball scholarship. He runs the decathlon at Syracuse. He's nationally ranked. But he chooses football. And let me quote what you say in the book. He said, football spoke to Jim Brown most vividly because football, more than any other sport, allowed him to match his heart against those of others. Explain what you mean.
You know, he really could have been great at anything. But what I think Jim Brown, what he represented was he always wanted to be the best. Like he was the competitive spirit of him. And that was on the field, off the field. He wanted to be the best. He wanted to be the most dominant. And football was the sport that really allowed him to do that more than any other sport. Jim Brown was one of the first who used to, as a running back, would purposely run into defenders just to let them know that he was there and he was going to run them over at any time in any place. And there was so much about him. He understood his own mythology in so many ways. Hmm. You know, Jim Brown, one of the things he was very famous for at the time is how slowly he would get up after every play, as if he was hurt, as if he couldn't get back up. And he would slowly, slowly get up, and he would slowly work his way back to the huddle. And then on the next play, he would be Superman again. And it was all a part of who he was. Like, everything about the way he played football was directly from his heart. I mean, that's he was every bit the person that he wanted to be on a football field. And the game will have, you know, players that have more success. People are going to set more records. He's not even close anymore to the all-time rushing record. I mean, he's long been surpassed as far as statistics. But as far as a single person dominating a sport, I don't think we'll ever see anything like that again.
Mm. Is Roger Staubach's Hail Mary pass the first time we thought of it as in those terms, Hail Mary?
It's very interesting, and I'm glad. Thank you for setting me up on that, because the Hail Mary is obviously I write about the history of the Hail Mary in football. What they used to call Hail Mary plays was different than what we think of it now. Like, coaches used to they used to say the words Hail Mary in disgust. You know, said somebody would score a touchdown on a crazy, you know, desperation play. And the coach after the game would say, it was nothing but a Hail Mary, right? And before that, the Hail Mary actually had a real religious connection going back to Notre Dame. So the first one to actually throw it at the end of a game, desperately needing to win, it was against the Vikings. It was a playoff game. It sure seemed like the Cowboys were done. Roger Staubach basically drew the play up in the dirt. He told Drew Pearson, just you go and I'll throw the ball as far as I can. And that was sort of the entirety of the first Hail Mary.
Roger takes the snap, pumps it once. He's going long down the near sideline for Drew Pearson. Pearson makes the catch at the 5, touchdown. Pearson goes in for the touchdown and the Cowboys score. What you believe it?
Tom Landry, after the game, he was the coach of the Cowboys, started talking about how they used to practice the Hail Mary, and Roger Staubach and Drew Pearson just broke down laughing because it was completely made up on the spot. Now, we see Hail Mary's attempts all the time. We see actually quite a few successful Hail Marys. So now it's become a thing. But at the time, it was truly a Hail Mary. It was truly just kind of a prayer thrown up. And it was Roger Staubach who, after the game, said, I said a Hail Mary, and that's how that play got named.
I love that you included the Beast Quake in here, number 43. We don't have to say a lot about it. It's just an incredible run by the running back of the Seattle Seahawks, Marshawn Lynch, that caused this eruption, this literal quake. Just say something about the Beast Quake.
The run itself is truly mind-boggling. It is. He breaks 9 tackles.
Crowd silent now, as opposed to when the Saints have the ball. Oh, look at this run. What a run. Marshawn Lynch still on his feet. Has blockers now. He's dancing his way for the touchdown.
You know, now Marshawn Lynch is an actor. He's a celebrity. He's a very, very funny guy. But at the time, he was, the Seahawks had traded for him, and there was not really this sense of what he was. And he just wasn't that big a guy. I can remember just being next to Marshawn Lynch and thinking, I mean, he's just not that big. And he would say that when he got on a football field, he would go into beast mode. And when he went into beast mode, nobody could tackle him.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what that play was. And he did it in Seattle. In a playoff game when the Seahawks, nobody was expecting them to win. That was not a very good Seahawks team. And the place went crazy. And there's a longstanding argument between the city of Seattle and the city of Kansas City about which is the loudest stadium in football. But with the Beastquake, the crowd was so loud that it actually appeared on the Richter scale at the earthquake center near the stadium. And so that's how they named it, the Beastquake. And that could not be better. That just could not be better.
I love this story that you include in the top 100 from a high school football game in a rural Ohio community called McDermott. This is the story of Jake Porter. One of the things I also love about it is the whatever tape that exists, there's not a lot. It's pretty grainy, and there's something that I like about that in some way because it's not just so, – but tell the story. This is called the winning touchdown, as you put it.
The winning touchdown. This was a really pivotal story for me. In a little town called McDermott, Ohio, there was a kid named Jake Porter who was beloved by the school. He had chromosomal fragile X syndrome, which makes learning difficult. But he was in high school, and he was a member of basically every team, and everybody really loved him, and he loved everybody. He was just one of these super sweet kids that everybody likes. And it's his senior year, and he's on the football team, and he's never played in a game, and his coach decides that he wants to put him in a game, and they're not very good, and he knows they're going to get destroyed by the team they're playing the next week. So he calls up the coach of the other team, explains the situation. The coach says, yeah, I'm sure that'll be fine, and they go to the game, and sure enough, they're losing. It's at the end of the game. They're losing by 44 or something like that. Yeah. And the coach is ready to put Jake into the game. And suddenly the other coach calls timeout. And the coach comes to the middle of the field and calls out Jake's coach. And the two are talking and everybody's watching them and wondering what's going on. And they seem to be arguing about something. And when the argument's over, the discussion is over, they both go back to the sidelines. The coach calls over Jake and says, you're in the game. Jake is supposed to go into the game, take the ball, take a knee. He'll have his one carry. He'll, you know, have played in his football game.
Yeah.
So he goes into the game and he gets the ball and he starts to take a knee, and nobody comes to get the ball. Like none of the officials come to get the ball. And he looks up and he sees both teams lined up, and there's just a big pathway, and players on both teams start yelling to him to run. And he starts running and running, and the guys on both sides are running with him, and they all run into the end zone together, and Jake Porter scores the touchdown. And one of my favorite parts of the story is what the two coaches were arguing about was the opposing coach wanted to let Jake score. And Jake's coach was like, no, you don't have to do that. And the opposing coach said, no, he's a great kid and we want to do this. And I just love that so much. And that's what made me think, okay, well, there's nothing like that. That play is singular in its own way. And it's a high school play that, you know, at the time got a little bit of press, but very, very few people know about it. And it tells something about football that no other play can tell. And I thought, I want to write Why We Love Football. That's what I want to write, because I want to be able to tell about this game. And sure, there are things that the immaculate reception and the catch and the helmet catch and kick six and yeah, the play and all of these other very famous plays tell about Why We Love Football. But that play, in ways that are even hard to put into words, I think get at the heart of what it is about this game.
What do you think it is about Whitney Houston's national anthem that she sang at the Super Bowl in 1991 that tells us about the history of football? Because that's in here, too. That's number 76 for you.
Yes, it is. This was 91. It was right just after the United States had gone to Kuwait, we were at war. The country was at war, and it had been a long time since the country had been at war, and everybody was sort of getting used to what was happening, and there were all sorts of concerns at the Super Bowl that there were going to be terrorists. You know, they grounded all the helicopters and did all kinds of things. And there was just a real edge to what was happening. But there was also obviously this sense of we're coming together as a country. And here you have Whitney Houston sort of, I mean, absolutely in her prime. And she chose to do the national anthem in her own way. It's much slower than actually the Super Bowl wanted. They actually wanted her to re-record it, but it was utterly perfect for the moment. What it says about football is a lot, and a lot of that is connected to patriotism and football's place in America. But it's also the day that America came together, more than any other day, was the Super Bowl. That was the one thing that could get every single person basically on board. Everybody was, you know, watching that game, as 150 million were last year. And so I think part of it is that a singular moment like that, if Whitney Houston had sung that same exact anthem in that exact situation at the NBA final or at the World Series, it would have still, I truly believe, have been an incredible moment. But it wouldn't have been this sort of crescendo of what America was feeling at that moment.
Joe Posnanski. His book is Why We Love Football, A History in 100 Moments. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those not following, it's the playoffs for football. The sports writer Joe Posnanski is with us explaining why Americans love the sport so much. Back now to our conversation. You know, we were talking as a team, the team for the show, earlier about moments, and somehow it came up, the voice from the old NFL films guy, remember Don Facenda? You know, the autumn wind is a pirate, you know, and
yes.
And there's a one of the moments you mention sort of casts back to the early days of the NFL. This was 1967. This is the Ice Bowl, one of the Ice Bowls, it's the game between the Packers and the Cowboys. 13 below. I think that it, at the time it was like, what was it? The coldest game recorded or one
still,
of those
still
at the
is.
Time?
Still is. Still the coldest game, yeah.
And I don't know. Will you just talk a little bit about this? The 16 seconds left. Packers are trailing the Cowboys 17-14. They're on the 1 yard line. These are the days when Bart Starr was playing quarterback for the Packers. I don't know. I just think these moments were great. Say something about the Ice Bowl.
Yeah, there's so much to say. And since you mentioned John Facenda, I think that's where you start. Football did not have its own mythology. It really did not. Baseball did from the very start. Baseball had this American folk tale, folk hero kind of story, you know, going back to Babe Ruth, but even going before Babe Ruth. And football really didn't. Football, you know, it was just not popular enough to build its own mythology. And in the early 1960s, so just 3, 4, 5 years before the Ice Bowl, a guy named Ed Sable goes to the commissioner of football, at the time was Pete Rozelle, and says he wants to buy the rights for the NFL championship game. And at the time, nobody cared about the NFL championship game or the rights to it. I mean, he wanted the rights to not for the actual television, but for to do a film on the game after it was played. And Pete Rozelle said, well, what experience do you have? And Ed Sable goes, well, I filmed all my son's high school football games. And because the NFL was so different then and so nothing then, Pete Rozelle sold him the rights for $5,000. Wow. And Ed Sable and his son Steve created NFL Films. And that's where John Facenda is. That's where The Autumn Wind is a Raider. That's where all of these very famous things happen. And what Steve in particular, Ed launched it, but Steve was in many ways the genius behind it. And what Steve did was create this mythology for football. And I write about this in the book. Before Steve Sable, when games were played in the mud, it were just games played in the mud. It was that, I mean, it was just like, well, it was dirty and messy. But he brought like this rough poetry to the idea of playing in the mud. There is no reason, like from any, you know, just from any logical standpoint, you should not play a football game when it's 13 degrees below zero. Just there's no reason to play a football game in those circumstances. But the game was so cold, I should say, that the Cowboys receivers, when they were not running on pass plays, they would literally have their hands jammed in their pockets to because they were so cold. And the game comes to the end, as you mentioned, and basically at the time the Cowboys are winning, but they're winning by three. So if the Packers score a touchdown, they win. I mean, yeah, they score a touchdown, they win, but if they kick a field goal, they can tie. And it's third down, and they had tried to get in on first and second down, but they couldn't get in because nobody on the field could get their footing. So every time they handed the ball off, the guys were just falling down. The field was on a skating rink. It was completely frozen. So on third down, the Packers called their last timeout. And Vince Lombardi's on the sidelines, and Bart Starr runs over to him. And Vince Lombardi calls the play, and Bart Starr goes, you know what? Let's not do it that way. I'm standing up. I'm already right there. I'll just take it myself. And Vince Lombardi famously goes, all right, you do it, and let's get the hell out of here.
17-14.
And Bart Starr took the snap, pushed himself forward, and he scored the game-winning touchdown.
Takes the snap. He's got the quarterback sneaking. He's into the touchdown, and the Packers are out in front. 20-17. There's 13 seconds joined on the clock, and the Green Bay Packers are going to be world champions, NFL champions for the third straight year.
It's a one-yard quarterback sneak that, under any other circumstances, would have just been nothing. But because of NFL Films, because it was Vince Lombardi and Bart Starr and the famous Dallas Cowboys and Lambeau Field, you know, all of these things, it's legend.
Thriller in the 8 years of broadcasts that we've done for the Green Bay Packers, but we've never taken it down to the wire like this for an NFL championship. The only thing that I can possibly remember that would compare to it was the tension riding on the sudden death overtime that we played against the Baltimore Colts.
So you don't pick a number one.
Well, I sort of pick a
number one. All right, well, let's talk about number one. This is John Madden. February 1st, 2009, the last game that John Madden called.
Yeah. The thing to me about John Madden's last game is, of course, it's not just John Madden's last game. It's the Super Bowl between the Steelers and the Arizona Cardinals. And the thing about that game is it's the perfect storm. It is the absolute, nothing like it has ever happened in NFL history, where at least two and maybe three of the greatest plays in NFL history all happened in that same game. And it happened with the greatest announcer and the guy who probably moved football more over the last half century than any other single person, John Madden, calling his last game. So I felt like, you know, sure, I could have put the immaculate reception number one. It is every, it should be there. It could be there. I thought any of the top 10, I could have made an argument for as number one. I mean, there's the play is, yep. the Stanford Cal game where the band ran on the field. Yep. That absolutely could have been number one. The kick six, Alabama and Auburn, where the guy returned the missed field goal, to win the game from Auburn, absolutely could have been number one. There are so many that I think could have been number one. But I think what stood apart for this one is when you have so many things happen that explain what it is we love about the game, you have a truly ludicrous 100-yard interception return.
From the gun, Steelers show blitz. Here they come. He gets it away, and it's picked off at the goal line. There's a flag thrown on the run back, James Harrison.
You have, for the Cardinals, Larry Fitzgerald, he had the greatest run as a wide receiver that any receiver's ever had in the postseason.
And it's going to be a fade for Fitzgerald, who's going to go up and make the catch for the touchdown.
You have a last-second touchdown pass where the receiver makes an astonishing catch and somehow gets both toes in bounds. It's impossible. It's utterly impossible.
Roethlisberger has time, throws to the back of the end zone, and it is caught for a touchdown by Holmes. Incredible.
You have all of that happening in one game, one remarkable game, and you have it being called for the very last time by John Madden.
Unbelievable. You know, could Kurt Warner do it? Could the Cardinals do it? Then they do it. You know, could the Steelers do it? Could Ben Roethlisberger do it? Then they did it.
And I thought, this is perfection. This is like what the entire, all of football was leading up to this moment. Like every part of football history was leading up to this game and this moment and all that happened here. And once I thought of it that way, I thought, well, that's number one. For me, that's number one.
You know, you think that both of these teams played so well, and the gap between winning and losing is the widest gap in sports, but they were so close and they played so hard, and both teams, when they were down and they kept fighting and coming back, and to me, this is the way football should be played. This is what the NFL is, and this is a heavyweight championship fight.
Back and forth, and how many different storylines and twists did this one have, and how many different.
Here's a little coda, and it refers to something you write toward the end of the book. This, you tell the story where you're. You're playing chess with Priest Holmes. He was a running back for the Kansas City Chiefs. At first you just did it because of a story. Like you learned he played chess, and he's this. For people who don't know, he's this kind of famously inscrutable, kind of mysterious guy. Would like go days without talking, kind of enigmatic like guy. But he liked to play chess, and so for a story, I guess the idea is I'm going to go play chess with him, and you do, but. Then he wants to keep playing with you. And I really like the message of this story because I think it says something about, I don't know, there's something kind of profound in something he tells you. Do you mind talking about that?
No, not at all. Priest was, he was something. And, you know, he was at the time, for those 3-4 years, he was the best player in football. He set the record for most touchdowns in a season during that time. He led the league in rushing a different year. He was on his way to, you know, probably the greatest individual season separately from those other two before he got hurt. So he was just this, he was incredible. And his story was incredible. He was undrafted out of Texas, yeah. Kind of found his way to the Ravens. Went there and was kind of served as a leader type of guy and won the Super Bowl. And then the Chiefs brought him in not to be their number one running back. They brought him in to be kind of a third down guy for them. Yeah. So everybody wanted to do the Priest Holmes stories, right? And all the papers, all the magazines, all of the television stations. And he was, as you say absolutely correctly, he was just this very inscrutable guy who would, he wasn't mean or rude or that he just didn't want to talk, just wasn't interested. Wasn't interested in fame, wasn't interested in being interviewed. He just wasn't interested in any of it. And of course, you know, I'm the columnist at the Kansas City Star, and I've got to figure out a way, how can I get through to him? And I find out that he does play chess, and he actually started a little chess club in Kansas City. And I played chess. My father was a very, very good chess player. So he taught me how to play. So I played. I wasn't any good, but I played. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'll just go out to one of his chess events with the kids and kind of watch him with chess. And so we go out there, and at some point he's like, do you play? And I said, well, I know how to play. Yeah, I play. And he goes, all right, well, let's play. And so I played a little chess with him. And then the next week, you know, the story comes out. I think he's happy with it. I says, you know, everybody seemed to be happy with the story itself. And like Thursday of the next week, he calls me and he goes, hey, come out to the stadium tomorrow, that we need to play chess again. And I'm convinced it's because he beat me so soundly the first time. So I'm like, sure. So I go out the next week and I play chess with him, and he beats me again. And then the next week again, and the next week again. And it finally just becomes sort of a like a Fridays with Priest kind of thing. And this is during a really remarkable season for him, for the team. And I'm kind of in the middle of it. I mean, it was really, really interesting. And Priest himself was just this very quiet, but very thoughtful. You wouldn't have known it because he was so reluctant to talk, but he just wasn't, is this incredibly thoughtful guy. And he was able to give me insights into football, some quite frightening, about what he had to endure to be the player that he was and the pain that he had to go through every week. But also just his philosophy of the game and how he thought about different things. You know, I always remember, and I actually told this to my own. We have two daughters, and I've told them this as sort of a lesson. He says that every game, there would be some mouthy little defensive back that would race up and, like, on the first play of the game, hit him. Like, really, really unload on him. Like, he would race into the line and just absolutely crack him and, you know, just hit him really hard. And the guy would inevitably say something like, oh, man, I'm going to be here all day, man. I'm going to be here all day. And Priest would always think to himself, no, you won't. And sure enough, in the fourth quarter, when the game was, you know, very much on the line and everybody's in agony and everybody's feeling it, he would get the ball and he would seek out that defensive back and he would run at him and he would watch that guy fall away. The guy never wanted to take him on when it was the fourth quarter. And he said, you know, that was his philosophy, is people turn back into who they are. You can pretend for a while, but at the end of the day, you are who you are. And I just thought that was great. But he said stuff like that all the time.
Yeah, I think it's a great, I don't know, it seems like one of the wisest thing there is. You know, it's such a perfect lesson to cap it all off, it seemed to me.
Yeah, I love that. You know, there's a very famous sports quote that Mike Tyson, the boxer, said that everybody has a plan until you punch him in the mouth.
Right.
And I thought the Priest's version of that quote, everybody is who they are, to me seems so much more profound. They're saying a lot of the same things, but it just felt to me like that Priest's version of it was just more profound to me.
Joe Posnanski, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
It's Joe Posnanski. He's a sports journalist. His book is called Why We Love Football, A History in 100 Moments. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1, Instagram at Radio West, and you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. This episode, we should mention, was produced by our intern, Stevie Shaughnessy, who did really great work for us. She's off to another adventure, and we're really going to miss her. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.